This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And this week, we're back. Back in the heat of the desert.
What are you...
Back.
It's so warm.
It's actually quite cool.
It's beautiful out.
Out here. It's basically fall.
No, he stopped that. I'm not ready for it.
Why?
Because I like summer. I like the heat. I like... everything that the summer brings with it, the energy of light. I don't like wind.
He's not a big fan of like wind.
That's
interesting. Why? That's such a weird thing to hate.
Because, like, all right, here's the thing.
Okay.
You look up the weather report.
Let's just derail. Just go ahead.
It's going to be like 75 degrees out.
Sure.
Cool.
Sure.
And then you go outside and it's windy. And it's like, oh, it's like a 10 degree wind chill. I'm ill prepared now.
Hmm.
My shorts and t-shirt won't satisfy. I will be cold.
That's why you just take a light jacket with you everywhere.
Everywhere?
Everywhere. Just put it in your backpack.
I need to carry around.
It makes me look like Barney the dinosaur. I love it.
You're telling me I need to carry around a jacket and now a backpack as well.
Yes. Don't you want to be prepared for every situation? When I walk out of my door with my backpack full, I'm like, I can do it.
That's why I
whatever
have
it is.
My mind.
That's not enough. We're moving forward from that whole weather discussion. Speaking of the power of the mind. No, that's not a segue.
That's horrible.
We're talking about gin, part two. I was going to get there, but I figured we'd just jump right in.
Got some stories.
Part two, it is just
incidences.
Just stories. So honestly, this episode might be 30 minutes. It might be an hour. I'm guessing it's probably going to be like an hour and a half because we can never get anything even remotely close to the time I would like it to be, but that's fine.
Well, the two times I had Siri read it to me, it was about 25 minutes.
Okay.
It was great.
Is that about how long it normally takes to read an episode?
Usually takes about three times that.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Maybe
because I also have her speaking rather quickly. That and she doesn't have me to interrupt her. So
the other thing that we're going to have a lot of today are fun pronunciations, fununciations, as if you will.
I see a word already right here that yep. I have no clue.
I see a few.
None. There's a lot of he's in there.
Yeah.
And an aid.
We're going to stick to pronouns because we are going to start first in the classical. Era, the classical Islamic era. And then from there, we're going to move to the modern day. I do ask your forgiveness for the names I'm about to massacre. I told myself I would practice. I did not.
Hey, massacre names, not people, right?
What did you mask? What?
Massacre names, not people.
Oh, yes. Perfect.
Right?
Good. Don't kill others.
Yikes.
It's a pretty basic one.
Although humanity still has an issue with it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
War is so weird. Also, people apparently really loved our philosophical milieu that we produced last week. So
what about the fourth dimension?
About the fourth dimension
God,
and
oh,
about
no.
if aliens have religion and all of that. So any deep stories or conversations you want to get into, let me know. We need to pad this for time. I'll just cut the rest out. But we are going to go ahead, finally. You've been rewarded for your patience.
Your wishes have come true.
Ha ha ha. And we're going to do this episode. I hope that's not what you use your wish for. That'd be a bad use of a wish. So some of the earliest stories that we have about the jinn and their behaviors, other than in the Quran itself, come from the 1001 Arabian Nights. Now, I thought this was pretty universal knowledge of what the 1001 Nights are and like what this book and this collection is, but apparently it's not.
I had no clue.
Really?
Had no clue
See,
until I looked it up.
That surprises the crap out of me. That's insane.
I didn't know what the Arabian Nights were either until last week.
Well, it's the same thing.
I know. It's the same thing. Okay, translated.
Cool. Okay. Well, so for that reason, I have it written down here. I wasn't really going to get into it, but I figure I will. Yeah? Did you have something?
No. I was just going to comment on my ignorance because I'm from America, I guess.
Yeah. All Americans are the worst. I agree. You heard me.
That's not exactly
you
what I said.
You heard me.
I'm just saying that American schools don't really teach the Arabian Nights at all. Never mind. I'm going to stop going off that tangent. I'm going to let you continue butchering whatever the next name is you have here.
Yeah, let's just move forward. So while our listeners may not know the story behind the Arabian Nights, which we're going to get into here in a moment, I guarantee that you know at least a few of the stories from it, although we'll kind of get into those and their authenticity in a moment. But I would say the most famous is Aladdin, the story of Aladdin and the wonderful magical lamp.
But it's a completely different story than what Disney has, right?
Sure. I didn't really look into it because we're not talking about it today because I didn't want to talk about Aladdin on a podcast about genies because why not? The other reason why is because Aladdin, as well as Alibaba and the 40 Thieves and the Seven Voyages of Sinbad the Sailor, those are like the three most well-known in the West stories that come from the Arabian Nights, but they weren't actually from the Arabian Nights. A fella who translated it from Arabic into French just added them. And so I didn't feel like we need to talk about it because there's more authentic stories that we could talk about instead.
Yeah, what's up with that? Is it like an artist signature almost? these two stories are for me. Let's see if they figure it out.
Let me just put those in. Well, what's interesting, right, is we all know Aladdin as taking place in, what is it? Agrabah.
Yeah, well.
Right.
I'm sorry. I was thinking of the Taj Mahal, which is what the palace is modeled after.
We think of him as more of like a Middle East sort of individual, maybe as far east as India. But actually, if you look, supposedly he's from China. It says far away, long ago and far away in China is how the story starts. And I thought that's really interesting. But then I read something else that said that back in those days being like the 17, 1800s, when the, or it was actually even, it was more like the 16, 1700s, when well-to-do people wanted to tell a story, no matter where it actually took place, they would just say, in China. China was like the catch-all for like anything far and away and exotic. So
gotcha.
Even
so,
yeah.
If Star Wars was back then, it'd be a long time
China.
Ago. Far, far away. In China.
In a galaxy in China. Yeah, pretty much. It's okay. The catch-all. It's and so
it's this mystical land where storytelling can take place.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so who's to say where the idea came from? We don't even know necessarily where that translator, if he just got the idea himself, if somebody else told him it for the stories. But basically, the interesting thing about the 1001 Nights is that they function kind of like a proto-inception concept. You have layers of stories woven within each other, and one character tells a story over here, which triggers another character to tell a story, and you just go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And the setting of the telling of these stories is sometime most likely around the 8th century AD. However, there's no accepted first date that this collection begins. See, it's said that the stories came from the mouth and mind of the fair, here we go, everybody.
Shea Atzadeh.
That's not bad.
That wasn't bad. I might end up doing that more than I'd like to do. I think it's Sheher Azadeh. So that's what I'm going to say. If you know how to pronounce it, keep it to yourself at this point. We've already recorded and produced the episode. And Sheher Azadeh was a daughter of one of the viziers of King Shirar. Now, that title, Shirar, simply means king. So he's just king. And that's just what we're going to call him from here on out. Yeah. And so the king had a beautiful wife, a queen who had been unfaithful to him. Now, to make sure that this would never happen again, he resolved to wed a new wife every evening and then behead her every morning.
Well, that's how you make an heir.
That is widely regarded as a bad move.
Yeah. Well, so much for your dynasty.
Yep.
Have fun there.
Now, by the time that Scheherazade got involved, 1,000 days and nights had passed with 1,000 dead young women to accompany the passage of time. And really what it came down to is that they were running out of young women. All of the common...
Yeah, the social, like, stress on not only, like, the nobles, but, like, the entire community.
Yeah. It's quite...
You're vastly... That's just genocide.
Yeah, it's very strange, isn't it? It's a very interesting concept.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
It's so bad.
Yeah. So it comes down to the fact that they were basically running out of women. They were going to have to start picking from the noble women. And so Scheherazade, I'm going to say Scheherazade, because I don't want to say that A at the end. I don't think it's right. I think it's wrong.
Okay.
Scheherazade. She volunteers. She says, okay, I'll do it. Theoretically, to spare some young woman one more day of her life to have. And
oh, not to just get it over with.
Well, that could be too. Yeah. First in, first out. And essentially, she goes to the king's chambers and she says, before the rest of it happens, would you mind if my little sister came in and I'll tell her and we'll say goodbye? And the king says, well, I might have killed 1,000 girls, but I'm not heartless. Am I right? Yes, you can do that. And so she comes in and the little sister says, big sister, tell me a story. And she says, okay, I'll tell you a story. And she starts telling the story. And through the telling of it, the king becomes so enraptured that when she cuts it off in the middle, he's angry and he demands, you need to finish the story. It was such a good story. And she says, well, my young sister here needs sleep. She is a little child and she needs her rest. But if you maybe don't kill me tomorrow, I can finish the story. And so this is where it comes into where right as the story's about to finish, she has another character in the story start telling another story. And it'll basically be like, you wish to know how I got this way? Well, it's very much like the story of the king and the banana or whatever. That's not one of them. I just made that up. I'm sorry. And then she'll say, let me tell you. And so then it just goes through. And mm-hmm. It's very much like Inception, where it's just like layer upon layer upon layer. And I think it's even been like Christopher Nolan was like, yeah, that's an inspiration. It's very interesting. And basically what it comes down to is after 1,000 nights and 1,000 stories.
So wait, he didn't catch on.
No, he was so enthralled with the stories. They were all so good. And so on the 1,001st night, he says, Scheherazade, or however you say your name, I have come to love you over the last 1,000 nights. Will you be my queen? And I won't kill anyone else. And she said, that sounds great. And so then they got married, and they were together conceivably until the end of their lives when they died. Maybe not.
Now, oddly enough, he said anyone else.
What?
he said he wouldn't kill anyone else.
Sure.
As he was talking to her.
Well, he just means in general. He's not going to kill her. That sure? Doesn't make sense. Yes, and so that is, she is the hero then. She's regarded as a hero and her praises are sung. And really what we see happen is the 1,001 Nights functions as a living treasury of folk tales and fairy tales and stories to tell children and to tell at parties and to entertain. Most scholars agree that the first renditions or first editions of the 1,001 Nights didn't have 1,001 stories. And even now you can get like multi-volume sets that have 1,000 stories, or you can have ones that just have like 50 or 100 or whatever. And it's pretty well accepted that basically you'd have, as time goes on over the last 1,400 years or 1,200 years, you'd have people say, did you ever hear the story of this? And it's part of 1,001 Nights. And then it just gets added in until finally you hit that. And it functions very much the same as if you were to combine the Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen and Aesop's Fables, pretty much all of the literary works of the West
right.
that have these moral messages and are there for entertainment as well.
And that's what I first thought about 1,001.
Yes.
Is that it was essentially the Middle Eastern variation of that.
Yes, it is.
Collections.
It is, but it's pretty much the, as far as I know, the more definitive. You don't have very many other sources. Like here we have a few different treasuries of fairy tales and that. This is pretty much it monolithically, and it's because of how it developed that you just, instead of Hans Christian Andersen saying, I'm going to make my own stories and attribute them to myself, he just throws them in, or the, you know, Arabic equivalents. As you might expect, 1,000 fairy tales from classical Arabia, a not inconsequential amount of these stories do involve the jinn and their traditional folkloric origins.
Did any of them have the three wishes, or has that just been...
It kind of...
A westernization of jinns.
You kind of get a whiff of wishes, but I don't know that you have three specific wishes or like anything in that aspect. Now, again, that's where maybe if I had done more research into Aladdin, we'd see that.
Well,
but even that was invented by, Antoine Galland was the translator.
And I did do a little more research on the three wishes concept. And from all that I can gather is that it is a lot for storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Three is a very, very important number. It has a beginning, a middle, and end to it. Two is enough to establish essentially a pattern. And then the third one is the one that breaks it in order to have that kind of moral compass. So it is probably just a variation just for storytelling.
Wow, three is such an important, not only in fairy tales, but like, I mean, Shakespeare had the rule of threes, and just in modern writing, you're supposed to
in storytelling
to
in
give
general.
three examples or three. Yeah, three is an interesting number. The magic number, some say.
Okay.
Talking about three. It's a magic number.
Anyway, you do actually have stories from Arabian Nights, right?
Do you have a couple? I have one story.
And then we have some newer ones
as well.
More modern?
Okay. Yes, because the entire point of this episode is to kind of give you a feel for the eyewitness accounts of the jinn, and I thought it was wrong to simply dismiss all of the stories out of hand of the Arabian Nights. However, they do function as fairy tales, so they're not necessarily meant to be taken as literally as our other stories we're going to talk about are. But the main story that we're going to talk about here is the story of the jinn and the fishermen. This is the second top-level story. So basically, as Scheherazade.
This is a tier two story.
Well, it's tier one. It's tier one. You have Scheherazade. That is the pinnacle story. That's the top story. And then you have different, I think there's like three or four different actual top level stories that then all of the other stories are.
Okay. Now I understand. Okay.
So yeah, there were like one or two.
This is one of the very, very first stories where they get splintered off from there.
Yeah. And so basically, she does end stories, but then she just starts and tells half of another story, even because it's like, oh, it's midday. You can't kill me at midday, so let me go ahead and tell another story, that sort of a thing. And so this would be the second first. Yeah, it's insane. It's awesome. So this story, I'm gonna go into storytelling mode here. Thank you, Fritch. It is the story of the jinn and the fisherman. Now, the fisherman was, as fishermen are wont to be, very, very poor. Every morning he set out with the goal to catch just enough food to feed his family and himself. However, it was not uncommon for him to return empty-handed. Now, this was partially due to this fisherman's superstitious tendencies that prohibited him from casting his net more than four times during a single voyage.
Is that based in anything?
No. Okay. Not as far as I could tell. Okay. I had the same thought. I really think it just comes down to like the same way people wear different socks on game day, that sort of a thing. It's just his
personal superstition.
Personal belief. At least I couldn't find anything.
Sounds like a bad one.
Yeah, it's kind
of... When you're trying to catch fish.
When you're trying to survive, it's not great. But so be it. And from here, it gets a little formulaic, okay? So the first cast of the day, it seems very promising. He heaves out, and he starts to grunt and to groan as he's bringing up this massive, what he just assumes has to be a massive bounty of fish. And as it gets up and up and up, he realizes it looks a little weird, and he finally pulls it from the water into the boat, and the boat rocks a little bit, and he sees that it is not a fish. It is the waterlogged carcass of a donkey, which is probably...
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Probably the worst thing you could pull out of the ocean, I would say.
That's... No.
No?
You could probably do worse.
Like what?
Well, that's really odd. I pictured him on like a river for some reason, like on a big river.
It could be a river, it could be an ocean, it could be... No, it's a lake, it's actually a lake. Is what it is, yeah.
Poor donkey.
Poor
that
donkey.
That donkey had a you story just to tell.
Wonder how it got out there, right?
Yeah.
Now, he tangles with the carcass, and he's trying to get it out of the net, and unfortunately, he has to cut a few of the bonds of the net to get it out, and then he has to spend a disproportionate amount of time sitting there and reweaving the net so that he can continue to cast, and when he does, he throws his cast out again, and he gets yet another very heavy pull, and as he's pulling and pulling and pulling, he says, well, this one has to be fish, and sure enough, as it comes up, it's not a carcass of a donkey. But it is a basket full of trash. A trash basket, as it were.
What?
I just don't know who goes through the trouble of putting all of their trash in a basket
and
before throwing it into
basket.
A lake.
Was That's the basket true. Itself also trash?
No, I think it was a good basket. Maybe it
Probably.
Was. I mean,
well,
I don't know.
Like if it was able to hold that much trash.
It could hold a lot
out,
of trash.
Yeah.
Now, thankfully.
Yeah, I think with the current, the trash would just wash right out.
Yeah.
That'd
it
be
didn't,
a basket.
Though.
Well, so he's up one basket.
Kind of. I don't think he keeps the basket. I'm pretty sure he throws it away.
Well, I see. I see why. Yeah. He's just a fisherman.
He's definitely not a businessman. He could make something out of that basket. Baskets
anyway.
Are us. You start with one crappy waterlogged basket, and then you make a basket empire.
Hey, it could happen.
Stranger things have.
Like pulling a donkey out of a lake.
True. He then, this time he doesn't have any trouble. He just unwraps the net and throws the basket back in. I don't know why. He's just okay. inviting, same thing with the donkey. He's just inviting himself to cast and get the donkey again, but whatever. The third time.
I'm assuming he put the donkey like downstream.
Hopefully.
Okay. We'll see. Anyway,
the third time he casts it out, and this time it's not heavy. He brings it up. It's just shells and sand and crap. And he's getting real discouraged. And he says a quick little prayer. He says, come on, I need this. I need a feed. I have two young boys. They're hungry all the time. I would really like to feed my family. And he says this prayer and he feels better. And he feels like this something good is about to happen. So he mm-hmm. casts out his net one more time, the fourth time. And as he pulls it up, he almost can't. It's almost too heavy. And he says, this is not the carcass of a donkey. This is not a basket full of trash. This is not just gravel. This is probably the heaviest load I've ever gotten. And if it's not fish, maybe it's gold, or maybe it's something I can sell to get fish or other food items. You know, you can exchange money for goods and services.
Right.
And that's what he was kind of thinking. As he pulls it up and up and up, he finally gets it over the board onto the boat, and he sees a strangely small yellow pot.
Okay.
And he says, that's strange. I have no idea how this pot could ever be as heavy as it is. And this is a motif in genie folklore. Is that a, like, for instance, last week we talked about the djinn, jewelry, djinn vessels,
right.
rings. If your jewelry that you get that has a djinn in it, if it's not super heavy, it probably doesn't have a djinn in it.
Okay.
Or a genie in it.
Okay.
So keep that in mind as you're scrolling Etsy. Now.
Yeah, post the weight. And it's not in, like, pounds.
500 pounds.
Then, boom.
Boom.
That's the winner.
Yes. Now. He makes
your shipping costs will be ridiculous, but that's the winner.
But it's you're going to get infinite wealth, so it's fine. He makes this old psychological connection that is proven by scientists in the modern day that the heavier something is, the more we feel like we should pay for it, the more expensive it is. And so sometimes, like, maybe...
Well, you are getting potentially more material.
Right.
Makes sense.
Right. But, like, for instance, if if you hand someone...
If it's just density.
Yeah, it's literally the exact same thing. You can even have things that are more valuable that are less dense that people are like, no, that's not worth as much. It's a psychological thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, then in that case, this has to be the most valuable pot in the world because it's probably the heaviest thing I've ever seen. And so he goes to try to open it, and he realizes it's sealed with lead and with a curious seal on top.
Well, that could add some weight to it.
Well, that could. That's true. And as he takes his knife, he pries it open, and suddenly smoke just starts to seep out. And as it seeps out...
That's got to be a good sign, right?
Yeah, or it's like a bomb. I don't know if they had... Well, yeah, they had bombs.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had gunpowder. Niter.
Well, China did. Huh. I saw it in the movie 300, so it has to be real.
Yeah, it's got to be real.
Yeah.
And the smoke, very much like the pot itself that was too heavy to be possible, the smoke fills an area that is too great to be possible, and it fills the entire area of the lake and the shores beyond.
Oh, dear.
And it is a very foggy, foggy morning now because of this. And suddenly, out of the smoke, he hears a howling and a screaming. And he looks and he sees a giant that was twice as large as the largest giant in the entire land.
So there's giants in the land.
Yes, of course there are giants in the land.
My bad.
One day we'll do a show on giants, I'm
Perfect.
Sure.
I'm ex-stoked.
You're ex-stoked.
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 Extremely stoked.
And the fisherman, as you might guess, is concerned, rightly so. And he felt the desperate desire to run away. However, he was petrified and could not move. And the huge being seemed to be in the process of swearing an oath, because it wailed, "Great King of the Jinn, I will never again disobey you." Now the fisherman assumed, for some reason, that he was talking to him, that the fisherman, by opening this pot, was now the Great King of the Jinn. And this is where you kind of see this idea of a wish. And he has it in his mind that if he's the great king of the jinn, this genie, is going to do things for him.
Right.
He's going to help him out and do whatever he wants. But the genie, who had before not even taken notice of the fisherman, looks down at him and says, "I will grant you only one favor, and that is you choosing how you would like to die." And the fisherman says, "Whoa, hold up. What's going on here? I'm the great king of the jinn." And he says, "You're not the great king of the jinn." And in true typical Scheherazade fashion, he launches into the story about how he rebelled against the king of the jinn and how in response to that, the king of the jinn then imprisoned him in this tiny little pot. Now, that was about 400 years ago. And during the first 100 years of his imprisonment, he said, "To the man who frees me, I will give the kingdoms of all the earth in exchange for my freedom." And then no one came. And to the second century, he says to himself, "To the man who frees me, I will give all the wealth of all the earth." But again, no one comes. And in the third century, he says, "To the man who frees me, at least he'll have a good life. I'll make sure that he's a very powerful individual in his own community." And then in the 400 years, he has gone from this to saying, "I hate all humans. Why has no one taken me from the lake and saved me yet?"
Well, so can other djinns interact with a trapped djinn?
Oh, I'm sure they could. No, I think it could be a human. But if the great king of the djinn seals away a djinn and throws him in the lake, you're not going to mess
with that.
You
probably don't want to follow him.
No, because then you're going to get thrown in the lake.
Yeah.
And he explains, though, he did. He explained how what was keeping him sealed there was the seal of the great king of the jinn.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it did have to be a human. Maybe no jinn could defy that. But yes, by year number 400, he says, "I will give but one thing to the man who saves me, and that is the method. I will let him choose the method in which he can die, because I hate all humans for leaving me here for so long." And that's about where he ends his little story, and now the fisherman standing there and realizing that it is his time to die. However, he pulls the oldest trick in the book, which at that point was probably still relatively new, and he says, I don't believe you. You can't fit in that little pot. I don't know where you came from, but you didn't fit in that little pot. Look how huge you are. That's ridiculous. And he says, for some stupid reason, very well, I shall prove you wrong. I shall go into the little pot, and then I shall kill you, and you will die knowing you were wrong, which is truly the worst thing.
I mean, let's be honest, though. If it's been 400 years and you get the opportunity to prove someone wrong as soon as you wake up.
It's the most delightful feeling. It's just delicious.
Hey, I'm back. He's wrong. And he's going to die now.
It's a good day in Genie Land. And so the smoke thing happens again. Because the smoke had pretty much gone away. The smoke thing happens again. And suddenly the smoke.
Oh, wait. The smoke is an atmospheric thing? Like it's body odor? It just follows him around?
Kind of, I think.
Okay.
Well, so he shows up.
Yeah.
And then as he shows up, the smoke disappears. So it may even be that, like,
or does he
is
condense
the smoke.
Into,
yeah, that might be what it is.
He condenses
that's
from the
probably
smoke
what
into,
it is.
Okay.
And so it happens again, and smoke happens again, and it starts to flow as if time's reversed, flow inwards into the pot. And he says, and he doesn't see the djinn, but now the genie says, look here now. See how my whole leg has entered into the pot because roughly the amount of smoke of his leg is in. And he says, well, anyone can get their leg into that pot. Come on. You got to get it all. Go in the pot. And he's like, all right, but then I'm going to kill you. He's like, okay, I agree to that deal. And he goes further in until there's no smoke left. And he hears very distantly from within the pot, there now, do you believe me? And he says, I do. Actually, he doesn't say anything. I just made that up. In the story, I said that because I thought it would be, like, badass. But he doesn't. He doesn't say anything. He just grabs the lid and puts it on the pot. And he's like, well, now the seal of the great king of the djinn is upon you, and I take it that you cannot leave the pot. And the genie says, if you let me out of here, I'll make you the richest man the world's ever seen. And he says, I don't think so. I think I'm going to build a house on the shore and move my family there. And every morning I'm going to sit there and warn every fisherman who comes to this lake not to drag you up. And if they drag you up, to put you right back. And he says, well, that's mighty rude of you. And then they launch into another story, like 500 more stories.
He's gone from fisherman to carpenter.
To
his interaction with
he's more of like a politician at this point because he's like on his soapbox preaching his message.
So in a way, he might become a powerful figure in
he
his community.
He very could. See, and that's the power of myth, the self-actualization. That's not even technically false. Yes, and so after they go through like 200 more stories together, then he throws the pot back into the ocean or the sea, and that's where it is.
Talking about taking a while to tie up a loose end there,
right?
Huh?
Well, they got to talk about it. So that is the prototypical genie story. You have the trickery of the genie. He doesn't do very well. And you end up with either a human being tricking a genie and surviving or a genie tricking a human being and the human being dying. Those are like the only two ways.
So typically interacting with a genie is a battle of wits.
Yes.
In one form or another.
Yes.
Who can be the most clever?
Yes. At least in literature.
Okay.
That's
that
not
makes sense.
Really at all attested to in real life interaction with the djinn. They're not. It's not like that usually. Although I did find the stories that we took here, and we're going to pretty much right here, we're going to get into the actual like modern day accounts.
Mm-hmm.
They're not very personal, but there are just like with demon possession in the West, you do have very personal stories of like the djinn said this and I said this and I did that and the djinn did that, and you have like this battle of wits sort of a thing. It just seemed a little far out for me, and I didn't really believe.
So no Riddler action is what you're telling me.
Yeah, pretty much. So
darn.
And it just wasn't, I don't know, it just wasn't as impactful to me as some of these stories. But if that's the prototypical classical story, that may have been what kept children up at night. That may be what kept people up at night back then. But nowadays, we have different stories and bigger stories, but not stories that have that definitive beginning, middle, and end. And that's really what I'm trying to say is there are those stories out there, and I just they don't do it for me. But, you know, search them out. Maybe you'll find them. But strangely enough, the first entire section that we're going to talk about here today are actually accounts of members of the military who, during foreign deployment in the Middle East, came across the jinn. And there's actually quite a few stories of especially U.S. troops stationed in Iraq and the area who have had paranormal experiences. The jinn are just one aspect of it. There's even more than that. But some of the earliest accounts I found of jinn activity playing a part in the war on terror come from 2003. And the stories range from eerie to downright freaky and dangerous. So on the first side of the spectrum, the kind of unsettling side, take, for example, the story of a soldier who was stationed in Mosul, Iraq, with the 101st Airborne. Now, pretty much every single individual that's related to an army story that we're going to talk about here is anonymous, and it's not really hard to see why.
I mean, yeah, I understand.
Yeah, it's, yeah. So, and especially for some of these, there are really good reasons to be anonymous, as we'll see. But again, I mean, reading the stories, I know that technically anybody can just look up anything, or you could still even then lie. But like, I don't know, the terminology that was being used, like it seemed like somebody who at least had knowledge of army terminology and army routine and stuff like that. So,
okay.
So yes, this witness, he talks about how he and two other members of his squad were positioned on the balcony of their station building in Mosul. He stated that when he's on security duty, as they were, they didn't usually carry flashlights. In fact, they used instead the Surefire light that was on their rifles as a way of just doing spot checks and things like that. Pretty much a average task that they were expected to do was to spot check pretty much every single car passing their location and to do so with their Surefire lights. Now, this particular evening, it hit about 2:30 in the morning, and there was the sound of a vehicle approaching, getting louder and louder and louder. And the soldier and his squad mates used their Surefire lights to do a check. And what they found was the vehicle seemed to be empty except for two individuals.
Okay.
There was a driver and a passenger both sitting. Well, obviously, the driver was in the front. The passenger was also in the front.
Okay.
So, driver in the back.
Well said.
Thank you.
I don't know what
kind of cars they drive over there. I have a way with words.
You do?
What?
You never know.
I don't know any car that's going to work better with the driver on the second row of seats. That would be bizarre. I saw a picture.
Maybe it's like a fan boat.
I saw a picture of like a 1920s Rolls Royce.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like literally like your living room and then a car on top, like in front of it taking you around. It was awesome. It made me think of Downton Abbey.
That's wonderful, Sam. Still haven't watched it. Probably never will.
That's
okay. I'll be fine with that.
You should. It's very, very good. Okay. Now, a quick note about the Surefire lights. As far as I could find, the Surefire light is going to be anywhere from 20 to 40 times brighter than the flashlight on your iPhone.
It's a pretty big range, Sam. That's a
bright
light.
In any case,
but like,
it's a very... Well, it just depends on the model.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what the standard issue model was, but the lowest one, because it's like your iPhone flashlight is like 10 lumens.
Mm-hmm.
The smallest or weakest Surefire light's about 200. And then technically they go way up from there, but anything too north of 400 is going to cause like physical damage and pain if someone sits in it for too long.
So that's actually that range is usually what we see in the upper scale bicycle lights.
Really?
For nighttime use. Yeah. 200 to 400.
Yeah.
So if anyone is like questioning exactly how bright that might be, if you have anyone that's a cyclist, they probably will have a light that is about that bright.
And you just look into it.
Don't look into
it. It's going to hurt your face.
Well,
it's bad.
It's going like to hurt your eyes.
Yeah,
and your face will react.
Yes.
Yeah.
You'll cry a little bit.
I hope so. Otherwise, your sensitivity something else is going on.
Stop looking at the sun. The eclipse is over. Wow, that was like a year ago.
I know. Anyway,
wow.
So these bright lights that were being used for spot checking, Sam.
I am just in awe of the passage of time.
Right?
Holy crap. Because like, here's the thing. Usually when I'm talking about time, I'm like, yeah, like a month or two ago, even like literally just the other day, I was at the Boise State game. Also, everybody who saw my funny tweets and liked them, thank you. I was at the Boise State game and I had helped my cousin buy a MacBook for his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And I recommended that they got the AppleCare, but you only have 60 days to get AppleCare.
Right.
And so I like saw him and I was like, oh, how's the laptop working out? He said, oh, it's good. Hey, could we still get AppleCare? And I was like, yeah, probably. He's like, what's the date range? How much do you have? I said, oh, 60 days. And he said, we got that like 6 months ago. And I was like, oh crap.
Whoops.
So like this idea of the eclipse being a year away is the first like firmly planted, that was a year ago. Wow.
Right?
Anyway, so we can all agree the Surefire light is definitely very, very bright. And you're going to have a reaction. And that's what happens to the driver. The driver has the pretty standard reaction. He kind of like twitches
squints,
a little bit.
Looks
away, averts his eyes. The passenger, in a move that was almost automatic, instead of looking away, looks directly at the person shining the light and directly into the light, as if he didn't even have to take a moment to think about where the light was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And as he does, he stares unblinkingly at the individual holding the rifle. And as he does, his eyes reflect light. And the soldier talks about how it was exactly what you see out of a cat or some other animal. The only problem, of course, is that this phenomena, eye shine, which I'm sure we've mentioned before on the show, it's the result of a part of the eye called the tapetum lucidum, which is a thin membrane in the eye, which assists with night vision. But humans don't have that. And humans don't have eye shine. And humans' eyes don't reflect light. Now, I don't know if you found or if you know anything about that. I was specifically writing this saying maybe Jason has an explanation.
Of why the person just stared right directly into it had eye shine?
Why he had eye shine.
The first thing that I think of is something to do with some sort of blindness.
Oh, interesting.
So that's the first thing that comes to my mind, because cataracts or whatever it is that like fogs up your eye.
It's cataracts, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that has something to do with
maybe
it.
Maybe that could reflect
that
the light.
That also explains a lot of why they don't really react to it, because they don't maybe feel like it's actually hitting them and doing any harm.
Yeah.
They just feel, if anything, like the energy from the light hitting their face.
A little bit more heat.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's the only thing I can really think of that'd be like a dead ringer, is that something previously had happened to their eyes that caused some sort of blindness, which just allows them to stare blankly in anything.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Or
in
that's,
the middle of
that
the
is,
night, that could be, you know, really spooky.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's like, yeah, there's no part of the eye that's naturally occurring that would cause eye shine, but I wonder if cataracts, as it is something that grows over the eye,
right,
if it could create more of a sheen. So that's a good idea. However, regardless, it's spooky.
It's a genie?
That's the idea, is that it's some sort of being, some sort of unnatural being. But that's all that there is.
Mm-hmm.
And as they drive, you know, they're only in the light for a period of 3 to 5 seconds.
Okay.
As they are, the gaze of the thing, or the person, we don't know that it's a thing yet.
Yeah.
The gaze of the person stays with the light. So he doesn't just turn his eyes and look directly in it and then stay. Like, he turns his head as they move to keep looking into the light, which is a little weird. Like, it's a little weird, but it's definitely not anything concrete.
Yeah.
It's just eerie. But I just hate that image of, like, a light flicking on and then someone just turning their head and staring directly at it. It really freaks me out for some reason.
Don't cataracts, man, I don't know enough about optometry. But doesn't it just like really, really, really fog things over?
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't you be light sensitive, but, and especially like a light that bright you don't come into everyday contact with?
Yeah.
So being transfixed on something that bright as a person with cataracts, that makes sense. Or, you know, like I was saying, it doesn't, any kind of weird eye, or like formation or something like that that's going on
could cause it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you would still know if there was a very bright light, but that just makes it even weirder that I guess he could identify in that split second. And of course, the other big thing of it that's lost.
Well, I mean,
through,
when like most of your life is dark and blurry,
true.
As soon as you see something bright, that's something that is out of the ordinary for you as well.
Like a moth to the flame.
Okay.
Big ups to everyone living with cataracts. Anyway, the other thing of it that simply cannot be explained through an audible medium is the fact that the soldier came away saying that was the weirdest I've ever felt. When that person looked at me, it just made my blood run cold, and I just felt eerie, and I felt weird.
Okay.
So, there's that. That's a little weird, right?
Yeah, no, it's weird.
Now we're going to move to something a little more weird. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So take, for example, this story, one that also remains anonymous for almost immediately apparent reasons here. It's the story of a young man stationed at the Forward Operating Base Endurance in Mosul, Iraq. And at some point during his assignment there, he began an intimate physical relationship with a female soldier that was stationed at the base. So that's why they're anonymous in addition to everything else. The woman goes by the pseudonym Sarah. The man doesn't even give himself a pseudonym or his name or anything like that. So they decide they need to have some alone time. And
yes. You just had to like have that yes. in. Wonderful. Okay. So
now, they decide the best way of doing this was to make use of a often unused bunker, which was secured with blast doors. It was stationed near the camp's generator. So not only does it mean that it would be even harder for someone to hear the inside of it, it meant that if those doors opened even a little bit, the roar of the generator changing in volume would be immediately saying, hey, somebody's in here, something's happened, and, you know, you're probably...
An artificial
bad things
system.
Are going to happen. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. However, and they did. They spent a few evenings in the bunker, and everything was fine. However, after the first few times, strange things began to happen. Sarah claimed that she could hear things moving in the bunker while they were in there, but the man never heard anything like that. And he said it's probably just hedgehogs because apparently this area is just lousy with them.
That's adorable.
I know, right?
That is so exciting.
I'll tell you how to win the war on terror. Hedgehogs. You can't be mad at those little guys. They're beautiful.
I feel like that's like, and I feel like that'd be like scampering almost. Not like scampering. Like,
you little scamp.
Yeah, like the little like, because don't they have nails? Like,
yeah, like a tapping. Like,
yeah, almost like a.
Yeah,
a rodent,
it would probably be a pretty unique noise, mm-hmm. I would think. However, Sarah didn't really buy that, but she said, okay, so be it. And after a few more times, suddenly the male soldier also started to hear things. But what he heard wasn't the scampering of a hedgehog. It was definitely the heavy sound of footsteps moving around in the pitch black darkness. Now, the footsteps started from one corner of the room. This happened multiple times. And the footsteps always started from the corner of the room and then meandered about the bunker until they came to a stop directly at the side of the bed. Now, the first time it happened, he was very afraid. But he said, okay, if somebody's here, like I think there is, there's really no getting out of it. So let's just turn on the light. And so he takes his flashlight and turns it on. And there's no one there. And there's no footsteps or no footprints, and there's no disturbing of items. There was no indication that the blast doors were opened, and there was nothing to indicate that there was anyone in there other than those footsteps in the dark. And this happened a few more times, but then it stopped mm-hmm. for a time. And over time, Sarah and the storyteller rationalized it away and decided that they were probably safe to continue their tryst there. However, one night, for whatever reason, the storyteller doesn't really tell why, Sarah shouts into the bunker, we're not in the mood to be messed with by whatever tonight. And she was half joking and she was half serious. The two did their thing and then they went to sleep. And as they woke up, Sarah woke up first and she heard out of that same corner that the footsteps always started in, she heard two distinct voices. whispering back and forth to each other, but she couldn't hear what they were saying. Then she wakes up the storyteller, who also hears these two distinct voices whispering, 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 and hears the footsteps. This time, instead of meandering all the way around the room, they come directly to the side of the bed, but the voices have stopped, and it's just those footsteps. And then the bed starts to shake violently for about 5 seconds, and then there is a deafening crash, like a giant metal plate had dropped off of the ceiling and came to rest directly by the side of the bed. He says it took him about 45 seconds to find the flashlight because he was so shook up and he was having such a visceral physical response. It takes him 45 seconds to find the flashlight. He turns it on, ready to fight whatever the heck is in there, and there's nothing. There's nothing by the bed. There's nothing fallen off the ceiling. There's nothing tipped over. There's nothing that could have made a crash. And of course, there's no person there either. And that was the last time that they ever went to the bunker. And the last time that I don't know if their relationship progressed or anything, but it didn't progress in the bunker. And to this day, he still has no idea what could happen and what could have caused that.
So what makes it a djinn or a genie instead of just like a poltergeist?
Mainly the setting on these ones. These
really?
First two.
Okay.
Yeah, just because it's in this area of the world where You don't really have stories of poltergeists. You have,
djinns are essentially the
djinn are the poltergeist. The djinn are the demons. The djinn are everything.
The scapegoat to everything weird that we don't know what's going on.
Exactly. Okay. For these first two. Now okay. The rest from here are pretty obviously they because these first two nothing is seen. It's only heard.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's that weird light and that light. Reflecting from the eyes, it kind of speaks to the shape-shifting nature of the djinn a little bit. The idea that it's not a human being, but it's looking like a human being.
Right.
This one, yeah. And really, I don't even know that the question or the storyteller knew that he was telling a story that could be a djinn. But you also have, of course, that idea of invisibility, which is very important to the djinn legend. However, not seeing things or seeing a little unsettling things, that's not the limit. See, the only thing I could think of is in the first story, cataracts is a good idea. I don't know if I don't know if they do reflect light or whatever, but it would make sense as to why he could look at it and also any other physical weirdness.
Yeah, like I was saying, any abnormal eye deformity mm-hmm. or anything like that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing I thought is, potentially, this would be like a weirdly specific, but potentially as the light goes through the window or something and it bounces out of the
windshield. Some sort
windshield,
of weird reflection.
Weird reflections and tricks and shadows. And that is so often what happens in these situations is, oh, it was a weird shadow or it was a weird trick of the light that caused this or that. However,
Mist Watcher.
What?
Or what the Watchers that we talked about?
Oh, the Dark Watchers.
The Dark Watchers. Yeah, my bad.
That's okay. Mist Watcher is a cool name.
Yeah.
I thought it was like a fantasy novel. There's, what is it?
Well, the it Mist, could be.
I think there's the Mist Walker.
Close enough.
No, Mistborn, right?
Ooh.
Brandon Sanderson. Brandon Sanderson has a series. I think it's called The Mistborn. It's super dope. The way that they use magic in it is that they eat like, they drink solutions or eat different little pieces of metal. And then, like, using a fire in the belly, they burn the metal, and it creates, like if, I don't know specifically, but, like, if you need to see something far away, you, like, burn tin, and it attunes your sight, or, like,
oh,
other things.
That's
interesting. It's really cool. I think it is Mistborn. It's dope. I read the first half of the book.
Doesn't sound very healthy, but it
no, it's probably
cool.
Not great. I read half of the first book and it was amazing, but then I did that thing where I never finish anything in my life.
I understand that.
Yeah. Anyway, yes. So this last military story we have, it goes beyond the realm of a little weird, a little eerie. It's downright terrifying and potentially dangerous. Now, this one does not happen to an enlisted soldier, but rather an ex-soldier who worked in the area of Karachi, Pakistan, as a security guard, protecting one of the more well-off native families. He had been stationed in that area, and so he just decided to stay after his enlistment and find work as a contractor there. And he had been employed for some time by the family. He had proven himself up to the tasks of the job, calm in the face of danger, and a sober, rational man. However, one night, as he sat in a chair that he used as a lookout spot, he seemed to lose all of that in just a second. Now, the man screamed so loud, I believe it was about midnight, the man screamed so loud that he woke everyone in the house, and he jumped over one of the gates into the courtyard in front of the house and then ran inside screaming all the way, carrying his semi-automatic shotgun with him that he had in his hands that he had used before and totally knew how to use and was fine with using. And when the family demanded to know what was happening to him, they were most likely afraid of some horrific attack on their property or people, and they were shocked to hear him describe something completely supernatural. Because he had been sitting in that chair, he was positioned right outside the gates of the house. And from there, he surveils the whole street from ground level. He had been technically, I don't know if it was because of like different business holdings and stuff, but technically employed to patrol and keep safe the entire street that they lived on, not just the one house. And from this chair of his, he could see up and down the entire street at ground level. Now, at right about 12 o'clock midnight, and probably most likely right at the stroke of midnight, if we're going to give it that kind of supernatural feel, he sees a rabbit hop out from between two of the houses into the street, just a few feet away from him, and it just stares him down. And for whatever reason, he doesn't just ignore it or think, oh, it's just a rabbit. He also stares down the rabbit. And suddenly, he sees the rabbit change. And suddenly, it appears to look like some sort of a cat, but not a normal cat. And he doesn't even describe how it changes. It's just that one moment it's a rabbit, and the next moment it's a cat. And then the man starts to feel this fear just bubbling up from within him. He doesn't even know why, other than like, yes, this is weird, but he doesn't think of it as a trick of the light or rationalize it at all. He just feels fear, and his heart jumps into his throat. His legs go numb. He feels like he wants to scream, but he can't scream even then. And then the cat transforms, and it lifts up into the air and takes the form of the torso, arms, and head of a woman, but it lacks the legs and everything below the waist. And it begins to float through the air towards him. It's at this point that he regains function of his legs. He jumps over the wall, tells everybody, and the neighborhood pretty much just goes on high alert for like weeks because everybody knows what this is, and everybody knows it's a djinn. And everybody knows that's bad juju. And over a few weeks, nothing else happens, but the man is never the same again. Like, and that's so often in these sorts of stories, one of the biggest indicators that something did happen is that he went from being confident, cool, knew his way around a weapon, felt safe, felt in control, to they eventually had to basically switch him onto only working in broad daylight because he couldn't handle being in that spot at dark anymore. And that's weird. And that's spooky. What do you think of that one, Chase?
Okay.
Okay, tell me.
Are we sure it's not sleep paralysis?
Not necessarily.
Are we sure he didn't accidentally fall asleep? Which explains why...
Right. He couldn't move. He couldn't scream.
Explains why he was awake, right. Saw something weird because he was still sort of dreaming. And because he was in sleep paralysis, he couldn't move until the fear and adrenaline built up enough to where it kickstarted his body again.
This is just what I pay you for, isn't it? It is. And I thank you for that. It could have been.
I wouldn't be surprised if something like that was the case.
Yeah. No, totally. And you have
to... Because the only time my legs go to sleep is because I'm on the internet too much as I'm doing my business.
Sure. Thank you. And the other thing of it is like you have to accept a lot of things for this story to be true. Like sleep paralysis is definitely the most natural option, but this idea of shape-shifting, this idea of flying, of human forms flying through the air and coming from animals. That's what really interests me, is that, yes, it could be sleep paralysis. And granted, he's in an area with a lot of Muslims who have a lot of folklore, and he's probably heard a lot of stories about the jinn by now, and that can be affecting the mind. But I just think it's, even if it is just sleep paralysis, I think it's so interesting the way that the mind operates on that and autofills that with.
And sleep like paralysis that tends to pop up a lot more in high stress individuals.
But even then, I mean, the biggest difference for me is that typically, not always, because there are a lot of stories that we talk about on this podcast that could be sleep paralysis and nothing more, but typically, like, the paralysis ends as soon as you're, or the hallucination ends as soon as you do well and truly wake up. Like, as far as we know, as he did then, quote unquote, wake up, regain motor function, and jump over the wall, like, this thing was still coming towards him. Then they went to check, it wasn't there. And just this idea that, well, where was I going with that?
Well, adrenaline has also been shown to, like, worsen
hallucination.
Your memory.
Oh, memory. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, just the idea for me that, like, even after it, he was like, it created such a difference that over the course, I think it was another year that he tried to work with these people and ended up getting his duty roster switched and all of that. But yeah, I don't know. I think it was something spooky, but that's just me.
That's fair.
And that's fair. So that's,
it's definitely creepy.
That's Jin versus the U.S. military. And I'll tell you what, the Jin seem to be winning in these stories.
It sounds more like the Jin are just toying with them.
Yeah, and again, that kind of trickster sort of mindset.
Stop playing with your food.
Just eat it. No. No. Not that time. However, kind of like I mentioned there, a lot of times foreigners and foreign lands get into their head ideas about witchcraft and of scary things and let it affect them. But it's not just
the stigma.
Yes. It's not just foreigners, soldiers and tourists who have stories of the jinn. In fact, it's the minority of stories come from these people. I just thought it was interesting that a lot of stories did come specifically from military members. And that's just scratching the surface. There's a lot more online that you can find. However, a lot, I would say the majority of stories come from the local people who live in this area and live there day to day. And in fact, in the desert towns of the Middle East, there exist not only individuals who have had encounters with the jinn, but entire towns that find themselves under siege by the jinn, as they have for centuries. One such city, the most famous...
Why don't you just leave towns?
That indicates a type of mobility that is not accessible to everybody.
That makes sense.
It's the same kind of idea of like, well, if the South is so racist, why don't black people just leave the South and come North? It's because you don't have that economic mobility to free yourself from that situation.
That sucks.
Yeah, it does suck. And especially here now, when you take that and you add the kind of traditional way of life that this specific city, which is a place called Balah, in Oman, the specific traditional, like, this is my home, this was my father's home, his father's home, his father's home, his father.
It's tradition.
And this is my business, and it's been the family.
Your legacy, your family's legacy is a part of it. Even it's if intertwined
you,
with the city.
Even if you have the mobility, you might have too much keeping you there.
Sentiment, yeah.
Now, Balah is a town that has been designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, making it one of 1,092 places in the world that are continually preserved for posterity, protected and under the jurisdiction of the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization to ensure that they will be preserved. Balah is protected mainly due to its impressive fort, which was built over 300 years, starting construction in the 12th century and being completed in the 15th. But the city is also unique in that it is an oasis settlement, located in the little hospitable area of an otherwise unlivable desert. Now, the entire city was once enclosed by a 12-kilometer-long wall, of which remnants can still be seen standing at the edges of the civilization. But the fort, which sits in the center of the city, also functions as a central point of eminence for the myriad reports of djinn activity in the area.
Perfect.
Now, it's said that even now, as the fort undergoes restoration, as it has been for the last 6 years, evidence of chaotic, evil forces are at play. Now, there have been numerous reports of work that was done the day before simply being undone overnight. They spend all day rebuilding this wall. They go the next day. The bricks are all in a pile. The mortar that was applied is just vanished, is just gone. And this has frustrated both local...
So we have mischievous activity.
Yes, yes. Okay. And you see this as well with the idea of the Huldufólk, the elves in Iceland.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking already.
You have multiple reports, especially one was that there was like this mountain or hill that they were going to tunnel into to create a new road. But it was traditionally where the Huldufólk lived. Like, it was a specific place where the Huldufólk lived. And every day, something else went wrong. The drills shut down, or, yeah, they would dig a little bit. They'd go back the next day, and it was completely filled in again. And all sorts of just weird activity.
Mm-hmm.
Elves, man. They're spooky.
Okay. I mean, they're not that spooky.
The fair people. And yeah, the same sort of thing here. And it has frustrated not just local laborers and archaeologists, but also the foreign UNESCO, like United Nations archaeologists as well, who have come there to do work. And it's said that that's a main reason why after 6 years, the work has not progressed to the degree that the United Nations had wanted it to at that point. Now, what could be causing this, though? What's the force that's causing this? Now, the easy answer here is, of course, the djinn. But why? And according to legend, there's more than a few good reasons as to why this fort should simply be left alone. Now, the legend goes that the original site of the fort before its construction was the site of an execution. There was a wizard who had been killed at that spot for practicing and spreading the practice of black magic. His followers, after his death, started to use this spot as an area of meeting and worship.
Hold on one second. Is Middle Eastern black magic the same as Western black magic?
I'm sure that the system and like the actual rites and rituals are different, but it's the same idea of like transgressing against nature, using dark powers, that sort of a thing.
Okay.
And after he died, it was said that his ghost... which is not something that happens in Islam. You don't have ghosts.
Right.
But his ghost did appear in the nearby settlement, in the back alleys of the area, and that his worshipers would flock to this spot and they'd perform ceremonies to summon him back from the grave in order to continue to teach them the dark arts.
Oh, fun.
Yes. Now, they had built a shrine to the man there, and the local people... terrified of the dark powers and emboldened by powerful warlords who wished to use the oasis as an outpost for their forces in the desert, chased the wizards out of the area, killing a good amount of them and destroying the shrine, beginning the construction of the fort on the exact spot of the grave of the sorcerer.
So where did the djinn come in?
We're getting there.
Oh, okay, okay.
Jeez, Bob. I thought you read these notes. Or was that just for effect?
That was for
effect. Okay, cool. I appreciate all the effect you do.
I try.
Are you going to down the fly? What are you?
Oh, yeah. That little thing's dead. It's sure going to die is. Today.
However, ironically enough, once the fort was completed, warlords and their generals would stand atop it, and in times of danger and need, the legend goes, from that point, summon the djinn to aid them. Of course, the idea is that they're standing on top of the fort, standing right on the same point of the bones of the dead sorcerer, just a little bit higher up in the air. And they would summon djinn to fight for them, to protect them. However, so that's one idea of where the djinn came from. Other stories suspiciously view the remains of old mosques just beyond the city walls now in ruins. The folklore states that there were three powerful mystics, and there are three remains and ruins of mosques.
Okay.
Each one of these mystics summoned a genie in order to bring their mosques from their homeland to that point. And quite literally, all three of the mosques landed or flew through the air and landed where they still partially stand today. And the jinn who brought them also remain to this day. Now, the local lore also points to a specific tree growing in the marketplace that was said to have been planted around the time of the ancient wizard. It's a frankincense tree. And it was somehow associated with his power, and it's feared. But through that fear, it's been protected for hundreds of years because no one will raise an axe to it because they're afraid they're going to die. Now, these legends, however, are not only remnants of a different place and a different time, but they serve as explanations for the supernatural occurrences that take place in Balah with astonishing frequency to this day. Take, for example, Muhammad Al-Hanai. Al-Hanai is a factory supervisor who holds a degree from a respectable university. He's a loving husband and a good father of five children, but he, like so many other residents of Balah who are reasonable, rational people, he has had his own encounter with the jinn, and he can point to you with geometric certainty the exact location and shape of the jinn that he saw in early 2015. It was the Yeah.
All right.
Not long at all.
No.
And according to him, as he's being interviewed for this publication, the Pacific Standard, he says that the jinn are most active at the final call to prayer on Friday evening every week. The jinn just, they're up, they're moving, they're doing things. Sometimes it's visual, sometimes it's not, but they're always
active,
working. Active. Yeah, in that time.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, back in 2015, what happened to him is it was in the middle of the night, which...
In the night.
No, sorry. No! Again!
Whoops.
Kanye West. Come on our podcast. No. Yes? Yes.
Yes.
Kanye would love to talk about some spooks. I guarantee it. In the middle of the night, which in desert regions actually gets very, very cold, very chilly. He was standing looking outside of his back window, and out of nowhere, he sees this swirling, unnatural fire, an inferno appear. The flames were green and sculpted. I think of it as like sort of as a triangular, it's a rounded coming to a triangular point.
Like a cone.
Yes, that's exactly the word for it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A cone of flame. It was green. It did not ebb and flow as fire does, but it stayed in the static geometric form while swirling and moving within the bounds of it. And it was crackling.
That's exciting.
Yeah. It was crackling with life, floating feet above the sand. And from out of the flames, he recalled the voice or the sound of a cackling, an evil laughter, which preceded the appearance of the form of a pale woman dressed in rags standing atop his adjacent tree. Okay. Until all at once, as quickly as it started, it all stopped. And much like the Skinwalker stories we've covered, Al-Hanai was reluctant to share his experience with reporters until they were sealed inside of a room of the house which did not have an opening to the outside so as to avoid the words being heard by the jinn which lived so close at hand. And there are other stories of possession as well, both covert possession, like the story of a man and woman who had lost 11 children, all by the time they had turned 3 years old, who after seeking help by way of an exorcism, of a practice like exorcism known as Czar, they now have three happy, healthy teenage sons, or else there are other more violent encounters, stories of people contorting into unnatural shapes and speaking with voices other than their own.
Could you imagine giving birth 14 times, though?
That would suck.
I can't.
Well, to be completely fair, I can't conceptualize of doing it once.
That's true. But like, holy cow, that's a lot of children.
Yeah. And especially just the tragedy of losing.
That's a lot of life lost.
It's not even just, I mean, not to like downplay. Probably
for very preventable things.
Yeah. Well, Jin, not to downplay anybody's like experiences, but I mean, it's so much different than like you can't get pregnant or you can get pregnant but can't carry to term. And then you, but then you have on the other side, like these people who keep having children, who keep living a number of years and then keep dying. Like, and according to the individual who performed the czar, the exorcism, he wrestled the djinn out of the woman. And once it was wrestled out of the woman, that, I mean, a month later they got pregnant. And then from there, nothing but happy, healthy kids. And it's that same idea, whether or not we believe in the djinn itself, it creates a psychological, measurable impact on the people.
I think it's interesting, too. So far, the two stories that we have that involve a physical representation of a djinn is a woman.
Yes.
While in A Thousand and One Nights, mm-hmm. we didn't... The story of the fisherman was that was a male or female?
That was
a
male djinn, male genie, but they can be both.
You mean either?
Or both. No, yes, okay. Either. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's no... I mean, when you think about it, there are male and female djinn, but any time that a djinn takes the form of mm-hmm. anything human, it's not going to be... Like, by default, they may just choose to turn into a male form,
okay.
but they could choose to be a female form as well, like because it's shape-shifting. Like the Daedra. Taking it back to Skyrim.
Any chance I can. So I thought it was interesting how, because again, in Western culture, mm-hmm. women tend to be the more like supernatural or magically inclined.
Right. Witches.
And we're kind of seeing a similar thing here. Same thing with the exorcism being done to the woman.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, I mean, once you're talking about like 3 years of age, I mean, it could be something going on that the man is doing as well without knowing. Right. So I think it was interesting how we aren't, but these stories are still having a pretty big effect on the views of women in this culture and society too.
Totally. 100%. I think that you probably have, I mean, I even remember reading, I didn't include it in here, but reading the story of a person in the more modern day, not in ancient times, not like yesterday, but the story of a woman who there was a village that like livestock kept dying, people were getting sick, it was attributed mm-hmm. to a djinn, and they found, just like as happens in stories of witchcraft, the woman that nobody liked killed that woman, suddenly everything got better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Same sort of thing. I really think that it parallels Western culture in a lot of ways, and this idea of scapegoating women is the biggest, yeah. Like another one of the big parallels between them, for sure.
So anything else going on in this city?
Well, beyond that, you have just your kind of typical djinn stories. That's the best actual illustration of a specific story that one of Muhammad al-Hanai and then the exorcism. But you do have just other typical aspects of the djinn. And one of them that I think is really fascinating because of the way it parallels other folklore traditions is the voice of the djinn. See, the voice of the djinn is a consistent concern in Balah. Just like the young enlisted man and his girlfriend, they hear these disembodied voices, right, coming from the mm-hmm. corner in the room. This is a very common sign of the djinn. However, unlike wordless whispers in the secret bunker, in Balah, the djinn prey primarily on hunters, on farmers, on people wandering close to the desert and outside of the city walls, mm-hmm. because the djinn will call your name. They'll call you using the wind. They'll call your name on the wind to take them out.
That's a very common like structure of folklore.
Yes. And specifically you
bad
see
things
it,
happen outside the city.
Yes.
And things call out to you.
Yes.
In familiar ways.
This whole idea, I'm reading The Hero of a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell, which is an analysis of mythological
every
motifs.
Hero story ever.
Yeah, the monomyth of the hero's journey and all of that. One specific aspect of it is crossing the threshold, the first threshold that takes you out of the known, and there's always something there. There's in the ancient times and in the Hellenistic period, you saw a lot of the time Pan would be guarding the first realm of the forest that you would enter as you left the city. Right. And it's very similar. But this idea of the djinn not only guarding that or playing in that space and being in that space, but the idea of them calling your name and trying to entice you out is also very similar to the idea of the Wendigo from Native American and Inuit belief, wherein the Wendigo, which is a cannibalistic spirit that possesses individuals but also just roams by itself, it not only calls the names of its victims, but it also mimics the voice of a loved one to do it. So if the Wendigo just killed your mother, it calls to you in your mother's voice to lure you out. And supposedly it's said that not a few farmers and hunters and wanderers wandered out into the desert never to come back. And this is something as well that in one of my favorite podcasts, Mysterious Universe, who do very much like this, except they do more of like current paranormal events, which is pretty neat. Mm-hmm. One of them went to Oman and talked about how the entire time he was there, he smelled this specific smell and he didn't understand what it was. And like, it took him 2 or 3 days until he really even realized that it was everywhere. And he asked, I think it was just a taxi driver. The taxi driver explained that it's just incense that they burn to ward off djinn, to keep the djinn out of their everyday life. But he was specifically told these things like, if you're going at all into the desert, don't listen to anything. Don't listen to what you hear on the wind. Mm-hmm. It's always, always bad. There's
well,
nothing
that,
worth
I mean,
chasing.
I don't remember where it was I saw it, but heck, it might have just simply been, it might have been like a movie thing or something where travelers that do get lost in the desert tend to stay lost because of our differences in our steps. So for example, for us, it's not a big deal. We have visual locations for us to know where we're walking to.
Sure.
Without having or having a changing visual of just kind of like an open sea of sand, mm-hmm. we have
no landmarks.
Exactly. We have no landmarks. We have no bearing. So if we step slightly further with our left foot than we do on our right foot, you're just going in a big circle.
A big circle, but a circle, yeah.
So that's you're actually not getting anywhere.
That's why, guys, if you're ever lost in the desert or in the forest or anything, you just wait where you are. That's the best idea, right? I know that's what it is for the forest. Maybe not the desert.
Probably close to it. I was going to say, learn how to navigate from the stars. That's probably
celestial
a good one.
Celestial navigation. That is a good idea as well.
That's how most people have done it for the history of our existence.
I know, especially in the forest, you're just supposed to wait where you are.
I always go downstream.
How many times have you been lost in the forest?
I'd never get lost in the forest because I always go downstream.
What does this mean? Okay, all right.
Streams lead to rivers. Rivers lead typically to people. Waterways are very important.
If you've never read The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, that's a great book about being lost in the woods.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's by Stephen King. It's great.
Oh, God, yeah. It has to be terrifying then.
It spooked me as a kid.
Yeah, that's
for
sure.
So... Now, in Balah, In Balah, the descendants, right, of Zanzibari slaves, they often serve as the exercisers, and they do this other practice called Zar that I had mentioned earlier. Now, much like the United States, Balah also has an uneasy relationship between the people who used to be slaves and the people who used to be
slaveholders,
yeah. And as we can see when we look further south into the voodoo of the Caribbean and New Orleans, entire ways of thinking are dismissed as devil worship due to the differences between the descendants of slaves and the descendants of slave owners or slaveholders. Now, in Balah, this manifests as a practice called Zar. Now, last week, we spoke of the Rukia, which is the official exorcism, which encompasses the use of the Quran and constant prayer to move a djinn from an individual. However, in this place, in Balah and much of Oman, it is sometimes suggested that something more is needed to rid the possessed.
So, because of my own ignorance, are those former slaves African, or were they a different location?
Well, they're
slavery?
From Zanzibar.
Which is?
African. Now, Zar is a more active approach than just reading the Quran and praying. Basically, the practitioner does not just attempt to remove the spirit, they actually attempt to remove the spirit by forcing the djinn to possess themselves in order to communicate with them to find the purpose for the possession, and finally the complete and total removal of the spirit. It also plays into a more nuanced view of the djinn, categorizing them as individual groups or families of spirits, each with its own method of exorcism. But the djinn do not only dwell in the desert and the hidden places anymore. A recent survey found that 80% of the world's 1.5 billion Muslims have some sort of belief in the djinn. This is not just limited to parts of the world where we try to write it off as primitive belief, or say these countries are still developing and that's why they think this way. Through this series, we've tried to talk about how believers continue to try to reconcile science with their beliefs, as all people of faith will for now until the end of time. And in the case of the djinn, these things are real, and they are active, and they interact with the faithful. Like it's said in the hadith, there's not a person on the face of the earth that doesn't have a djinn and are interacting with them on a daily basis, if only to try to tempt them to do bad and to sin against God. And to me, it is just an amazing representation of the beautiful mural of human belief and how interesting other cultures and other belief systems can be. So we kind of did a little preachy bit last episode. I'm just going to summarize it again and say, the more you delight in your fellow man, the more you find joy in learning about your fellow man, the more beautiful and complex and colorful the mural of human life and your own life will be. So that's my little preachy bit after talking about the horrors of the djinn. Jason, what do you think?
I actually just have a question for you.
Okay.
Do djinns have a animal familiar? Because a lot of cultures, especially Far Eastern, use trickery and cleverness and associate that with foxes.
Sure. So is there like something that is specifically thought of to be a djinn?
Yeah,
regularly?
like black cats and witches. Is there any kind of animal that has been brought up that is associated heavily with djinns?
Not that I
in that kind of superstition.
Not that I know of. I did read something. I don't think that they are necessarily always associated with djinn, but I did read that like one form that the djinn may take is like an ostrich.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay.
Yep, that's a pretty supposedly a common form, but I don't think it is that close of a link between certain animal and the djinn.
There has just been so many things that we've been talking about these last couple of weeks that are so paralleled to other cultures that I just was curious if you had found anything along your research that did point to an animal.
Yeah, not necessarily.
No. Interesting.
Let me see here. Maybe this is not from a very super reliable source. Maybe dogs, though, wild dogs. But then again, that's a pretty common fear item, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so
wild dogs are pretty heavily opportunistic. You're talking about scavengers, people, animals that are generally outside but interacting with civilization. That makes a lot of sense.
But yeah, other than that, I'm just doing a quick look here. I don't necessarily think so. There does appear to have been a game that was created very recently called Magic Djinn Animals. So I'm finding that. Let's see.
I have a feeling that has nothing to do.
It has nothing to do.
What I was actually curious about. So I am pretty good. You know, I think it makes a lot of sense that there's such a high belief in djinn when if we turn the scope and look at other belief systems outside the Muslim world. The majority of people probably believe in ghosts or probably believe in demons or something mm-hmm. of that supernatural capability. It makes a lot of sense for them to believe in jinn as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's like all sorts of, I mean, the majority, I looked up a few different.
But there's not a dead ringer is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
There's not something heavily associated with them.
Yeah. But the majority of individuals in the world, it's not as big a majority, but the majority of individuals, especially in the West, the figures I looked at were specifically the United States, do believe in evil forces like demons, not mm-hmm. necessarily even the devil itself, because that's a highly religious concept, right. but some sort of being that exists alongside us that is bad. That is a majority belief. And yeah, in the Muslim world, that is a majority belief as well. And it's the same sort of question that you always come, or that I always come back to on these things of why is that a majority belief? Granted, over time, it's because folklore has pounded it into us. Religion has pounded it into us. But is it that there is something more that is beside us? And maybe it's not the jinn, maybe it's not demons, maybe it's not anything we know, it's not aliens, it's not dogmen, it's not whatever. But is there something else here on this planet with us that we cannot always observe and that we cannot always see, maybe working for our good or working for our evil, depending on who you ask? And if there is, it makes sense as to why these stories and beliefs and stuff so heavily incorporated. It's not just that these things exist and they're out there, but don't worry about it. It's like you're always on your guard. You always have to be on your guard if you believe in that sort of a thing. And if there's not, there's 100 good folkloric and mythological reasons to it, of course. But I don't know. For me, and there's a specific word for this. I can't remember what it is. Most people agree it's not very academically sound. But it's the idea that mythology comes from some actual real like event. Like, not saying that there was actually Zeus flying about with thunderbolts turning into right. bulls there's and not impregnating women, but
actually Atlantis right. or El Dorado, but right. there's.
But there was a person once named Zeus who was a powerful warlord, and this is how he was commemorated, that sort of a thing. Most scholars disagree with that, but when you look at it at a more supernatural sense, I mean, there's something. That's the thing, is as we've done 76 episodes now, I've found my bar raised for the things that I believe in. I don't believe in as much as I used to, but the things that I do still believe in, I believe even harder in because of that raised bar. And there's something. John Keel would refer to it as the ultra-terrestrials, or the ones who share our haunted planet with us, is what he would say, our haunted planet. But haunted by whom? Haunted by whom?
Humanity's bad deeds?
Probably yeah. that. Yeah, okay. It's probably just our guilty consciences. Anyway, that's going to do it for the djinn. That's going to do it for us.
Awesome,
for
Sam. The djinn. I appreciate the stories.
Good. I'm glad. I hope people liked it. I think the majority of people did. I really like this idea of not doing, and again, it's not necessarily that we have nothing left to talk about, but we are running out of specific, like, on this date, in this place, this thing happened. Enough of that to be able to talk about it for an hour and a half. We're kind of running out of that.
Oh, boy.
And so while I'm sure there's hundreds of paranormal events out there that we haven't even tapped, I'm sure we'll get into it. I do like this idea of more subject-based episodes, which I don't feel like we've done too much of in the past. We're always almost always event-based.
Right.
And so I hope people have enjoyed kind of the broad subject overviews. I think we'll do a lot more of them in the future. So, yeah. But coming up, we do have a very specific date, time, place that we're going to be talking about.
No.
And that specific date, place, or that specific time, place, and event is the Gulf Breeze UFO sightings in Florida in 1987, wherein Ed Walters, a man after my own heart, combated the aliens wearing nothing but his underwear and his shotgun.
That's the way to do it.
We're going to be focusing on the Go Phase sightings for the next 2 weeks with our very good friend Rob of the Our Strange Skies podcast. Part one will be up about the same time we usually publish, except next week. So look forward to that. Other than that, Jason, you got anything else?
I've got nothing, Sam. I'm feeling great.
Nice. Let me do this here then. Not alone. That's us. We are not alone. We are alone in the universe. There's no way. That's just not true. I can't even say it. Okay. All right. Well, we would like to thank people who wrote reviews, but no one did.
Yes.
We did get more 5-star ratings, which we appreciate, nice. But nobody, as far as we can see here, wrote a new review. That's fine. Okay. We're not here to guilt people into things. You already do too much for us already. We love you. Other than that, just a second here.
You're good.
We do want to thank, though, we did get one new patron.
Nice.
And so we would like to thank Cliff Barnes.
Woo! Cliff.
Thank you so much for being a patron. It really helps to keep the lights on. We're down to one light this week. It's kind of dark in here. But if you'd like to learn more about how to do that, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Other than that, you can find me on Twitter. I'm BeerLordElfBane. You can find Jason on Twitter.
At Mighty Moit.
Mighty Moit. You can find us on Facebook, Not Alone Podcast. And remember, we are not alone, a community for the strange. And Instagram.
What? No, we're not. Instagram. We're not on Instagram. What are you talking about, Sam? Stop lying to the
Do it for
people.
The gram.
Oh, dear.
Instagram. Yeah. I'm not even going to say anything about that. I did it last week.
Yes, you did. Remember, whether you're on your first story or it's been your 1001 night of gin, you are
not alone.